Hey there, welcome back to Books with Bert. The Myth of the Robber Barons is the book. And today I want to continue our discussion of John D. Rockefeller, the first billionaire in U.S. history. His production of kerosene allowed millions of Americans to have affordable lighting in their homes. It's hard for those of us who grew up with electric lighting to appreciate the change that kerosene made for millions of Americans. Instead of candles, the innovation of kerosene lamps meant that homes were more brightly lit and safer because kerosene gave off brighter light and didn't pose as much of a fire risk as candles. Rockefeller's innovation made him a very wealthy man. Last week, I emphasized Rockefeller as an entrepreneur and the steps he took to achieve such remarkable success. This week, I want to focus on Rockefeller as a Christian entrepreneur. How did his Christian beliefs affect his ability to become America's premier entrepreneur in the late 1800s? Rockefeller was a very serious Christian. He was active in church life, in prayer, and in daily Bible reading. He said that the Bible inspired his business decisions. "God gave me my wealth," he sometimes said. Rockefeller followed biblical principles and ideas. One of Jesus' great commands was to love your neighbor as yourself. Rockefeller took that to heart in that he paid his workers competitive wages and rarely had labor trouble. Rockefeller also gave a tithe, that is 10% of his income, from the time he first earned money. He also gave regular offerings and tested Jesus' words that it is more blessed to give than to receive. As Rockefeller gave more and more money, he experienced the joy of watching lives improve and millions more people learning about Christ's love. As Rockefeller read his Bible, he discovered that Jesus was the ultimate giver. In his ministry, Jesus gave fishes and bread to hungry crowds who came to hear him preach, and ultimately he healed the sick and he gave his life so that believers in him and his message could go to heaven. Rockefeller's next step was to combine giving with serving others. In the 10th chapter of the book of Mark, Jesus said, "Whoever wants to become great among you must be your servant." That was the key for Rockefeller. Whoever wants to be first must be the servant of the most people. Now let's translate that into Rockefeller's actions as an entrepreneur. America had a capitalist economy, which relied mainly on free market prices to allocate goods and services. Government had a limited role to enforce laws, provide for the national defense, and protect citizens against fraud and crime. All of this meant that businessmen were free to compete with products to sell customers. A good entrepreneur is, in effect, a servant to customers all over the country. Rockefeller believed he was a servant leader by selling high-quality kerosene at affordable prices to millions of customers who chose his kerosene to light their homes. "We must ever remember," Rockefeller wrote to one of his partners in 1885, "we are refining oil for the poor man, and he must have it cheap and good." Rockefeller, to his own astonishment, became the first billionaire in American history because he served more people more effectively than anyone else. Not just in the United States, but throughout the world, Rockefeller's Standard Oil Company reached tens of millions of customers. In the late 1800s, more than 60% of all oil that was used for lighting homes in the world was sold by Standard Oil. Rockefeller was learning Jesus' lesson that whoever would be great among you must be a servant. He was spending most of his working hours thinking of ways to serve about 60% of the kerosene users in the world. For example, Rockefeller spent the bulk of one day trying to reduce the number of drops of solder needed to seal the oil cans he sold in Europe. He first used 40 drops of solder, and Rockefeller slightly spread out the solder drops and tried to use only 38 drops. He couldn't make that work. The cans leaked. So he tried 39 drops of solder, and after experiments, he was able to successfully seal his oil cans with 39 drops. Why, some people might wonder, would the wealthiest man in America spend a day of his life trying to cut the use of one drop of solder from a can of oil? Because if Rockefeller sold 5 million cans of oil, he had saved 5 million drops of solder, which was tens of thousands of dollars. Most of those savings were returned to the customer by lowering the cost he had to pay for a can of oil. In other words, Rockefeller had spent the day serving his customers. After Rockefeller, Henry Ford became the second billionaire in American history. Ford was quirky and eccentric in some of his beliefs. But in his economic work, he, like Rockefeller, gave millions of people an innovation that made their lives better. Ford's goal was to put a car in every garage in America, and he almost did that. By the early 1920s, over half the cars on the road in the United States were Model T Fords. Henry Ford, more than anyone else, had given millions of families affordable transportation. Contrast Ford with Sir Henry Royce of England. Royce was a fine engineer, and his elegant car, the Rolls-Royce, was a superb product. But it was very expensive and only affordable to rich families. Royce had some success, but because he served many fewer people than Ford did, Royce only had modest wealth. Christianity and capitalism go well together, in that both endeavors can lead to rewards for givers and servers. What's more, capitalism also takes two features of human nature, self-interest and competition, both of which can be negative, and turns both of these into positives. Entrepreneurs have a self-interest to earn money with their product. To do so, they must compete with others who are trying to reach customers with their products. The winners are those who serve the most customers. Therefore, the entrepreneur must always be thinking of the customer's needs. The natural human desire to pursue one's self-interest almost never produces servant leaders in socialist countries. Socialism relies on government to distribute goods, services, and wealth. Those in power set prices and allocate resources as they see fit. They are not necessarily dependent on the approval of customers to stay in power. Because socialist leaders often gain power by conquest, they control the means of production for their own benefit. They lead, and others must follow. Rarely do socialist leaders invent products and improve economic development. Instead, they command production and redistribute wealth, often to themselves. Sometimes they establish dynasties that last for many decades. In a capitalist economy, entrepreneurs only last as long as they can serve customers better than anyone else. Success is fragile. Self-interest and competition give incentives for others to challenge the top entrepreneur and outserve him. This entrepreneurial competition ultimately benefits the consumer in all sorts of ways. Now, in Rockefeller's case, he did well until he and his advisors made the decision in about 1900 not to look for oil in Texas. Other oil companies, however, struck gushers of oil in East Texas, and the market share of Rockefeller Standard Oil Company steadily declined in the first decade of the 1900s. In Henry Ford's case, he stuck with his Model T car. But General Motors began satisfying more customers by providing their cars with ignition starters instead of the dangerous crank start that Ford used. General Motors made added improvements in comfort of ride, diversity of colors for their cars, and providing gas gauges to help drivers know when to fill up. In 1928, Ford was so far behind, he stopped making his Model T altogether. The connection between Christianity and capitalism is clear, but often non-Christians can be effective entrepreneurs if only they adopt the Christian principles of giving and serving. Andrew Carnegie, for example, was the second wealthiest man in America in the late 1800s. He was only surpassed by Rockefeller himself. Although not a Christian, Carnegie created wealth in the steel industry by selling rails more cheaply than anyone else. In other words, he served millions of Americans with affordable transportation. We can see that entrepreneurs, if they want to get rich, must effectively serve many people. But what about their wealth after they have succeeded? Progressive politicians argue that society is best served by taxing the accumulated riches of billionaires. Of course, we already have a progressive income tax, which hits rich people harder than others. But what about a wealth tax on top of an income tax? No one needs anywhere close to $1 billion to live on, so why not tax the accumulated wealth of billionaires at, say, 5%? In other words, if a person had $1 billion, an annual wealth tax of 5% would require that person to pay $50 million. The billionaire could live without it, so the argument goes. And $50 million would do much good in the pockets of those who struggle for a living. A wealth tax is actually the transfer of power from the people who earn money to those in power who want to control how it is spent. It assumes politicians in power know better how to spend a billionaire's money than the billionaire does when the billionaire was the one who earned it. It is a confiscation of wealth, and such confiscation always increases over time. In other words, if a 5% wealth tax is good, maybe a 10% tax is better. Maybe 50% is best of all. But let's look at history to help us understand how Rockefeller spent his money once he became a billionaire. Of course, the first point is that he gave away a portion of the money he earned regularly through tithes and offerings, starting as a teenager. Even before the income tax, Rockefeller was a huge giver. When he set up the Rockefeller Foundation in the early 1900s, his giving became even greater. Rockefeller always gave to churches and missionaries, but at the Rockefeller Foundation, he established three other categories of giving. Improving health, that was number one. Second, improving agriculture. And third, improving education. In all of these areas, Rockefeller set out to solve huge problems. For example, in the early 1900s, Rockefeller's giving ended the problem of hookworm in the South. He identified 11 southern states that had more than one-third of their population suffering the debilitating effects of hookworm. His physicians experimented and developed medicine to rid anyone of hookworms. In agriculture, Rockefeller again helped the South by eliminating the boll weevil, which attacked cotton crops. In education, he supported and established colleges all over America. His giving of $33 million, which is almost $1 billion in today's money, to black colleges was important in training the teachers who helped raise adult black literacy from 19% in 1870 to 84% in 1930. The end of hookworm, the decline of the boll weevil, and the creation and support of black colleges. That was part of Rockefeller's legacy. The largest foundation today, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, approaches giving in much the same way as Rockefeller did. Bill Gates is trying to solve big problems. For example, much of the Gates Foundation money goes to finding cures for AIDS and for malaria. Bill Gates has also spent thousands of hours trying to improve sanitation in Africa, providing clean water and keeping sewage out of the water systems of those developing countries. How do progressive politicians today want to spend the money they get from taxing billionaires and others? Not very well. In most cases, they want to subsidize problems, not solve them. After all, if you solve problems, you no longer gain votes by subsidizing them. In the area of health, for example, many progressives advocate Medicare for all. Again, not the elimination of diseases, but the subsidizing of those who have them. Progressives also offer the Green New Deal, which subsidizes wind and solar power, which most customers have regularly rejected for energy created by fossil fuels. Rockefeller, in his giving, was a creator and a problem solver, not a subsidizer. Rockefeller, even in his old age, was always the giver. He came to enjoy the company of children and would talk with them and give them a dime each, $2 in today's money, to help start them in their lives. Rockefeller increasingly found it hard to be in the company of adults because adults were so often asking him for money, either for themselves or for some cause they were promoting. Making real friends became a challenge to him, and he often thought back fondly to his youthful days in Cleveland, when he would attend church picnics and talk frankly and amiably with his fellow Christians. But Rockefeller could also look back at decades of solving problems while building better lives for people all over the world. He had been a servant leader to millions. This week I have two books to recommend, an old book and a very new book. The old book, or should I say books, are written by Alan Nevins, a two-volume history of Rockefeller entitled A Study of Power. Nevins, a professor at Columbia University, wrote these two volumes and published them in 1953. The new book is by Lawrence Reed, and it's entitled Was Jesus a Socialist? This book is forthcoming next month from Intercollegiate Studies Institute. In that book, Reed looks at the teachings of Jesus and shows the close alignment between the principles of capitalism and the teachings of Jesus. These two books help us understand capitalism, and they help us understand Rockefeller. And that concludes today's episode of Books with Bert. Thank you all for listening. Be sure to subscribe and rate my podcast on Spotify, iTunes, or any other place where you get podcasts so you don't miss future episodes. And if you like today's episode and you want to find more content to fill your heart with love for America and for conservative ideas, be sure to check out YAF.org. That's the Young America's Foundation. The conservative movement starts here. Until next time, keep reading.